Crime Obscene is a monthly true crime podcast. Listener discretion is advised. On May 1st, 2001, Chandra Ann Levy disappeared without a trace. The 24-year-old had recently wrapped up a paid internship with the Federal Bureau of Prisons in Washington, D.C., but was due to return to her home in Modesto, California in time for graduation. But this did not come to pass, as 5 days later, on May 6th, Levy's family would alert the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia, or the MPD, from Modesto that they had not heard from her. The police responded by carrying out a welfare check on Chandra's apartment, which resided in DuPont Circle, but found nothing. Further investigating, and from Levy's own father, it would be learned that Chandra had been having an affair with a then US Congressman, Gary Condit. This information was corroborated by Chandra's aunt. But beneath this story of what sounds like a tale of scandal, seedy secrets, and murder, something that of which Hollywood itself could spin, beats the cold, hard truth. The truth of a truly horrifying investigation riddled with errors of judgment, media frenzy, and trials by both court and television alike. In today's episode, we will bring the lens back into focus onto that young woman who vanished 20 years ago and later would be found 6 kilometers from her home dead in the murder of Chandra Levy. Hello, welcome to Crime Obscene. I'm your host, Aaron. Before we start, I would like to tell you a little bit about the show. Crime Obscene is a monthly true crime podcast that explores unsolved murders, missing persons cases, and beyond. This podcast is run by me and me alone, so your listenership and feedback is greatly appreciated. So why not give me a follow on your favourite podcatchers and a like and review. This greatly helps out the pod. If you have any feedback, a case suggestion, or just want to drop me a line, you can do so by emailing me at crimeobscenepod@outlook.com, tweet me at crimeobscenepod, or on Instagram. There is also a private Facebook group set up where you can discuss your thoughts on episodes, recommend other pods, or just be part of a community who want to make a difference. That's Crime Obscene Investigators. Now, let's begin. Chapter 1. Crime Timeline. Chandra Ann Levy was born April 14, 1977 in Cleveland, Ohio, to parents Susan and Robert Levy, and was the oldest with a younger brother named Adam. The family moved to Modesto, California when Chandra was younger and settled in. Modesto, which is Spanish for honest, certainly played into its name when it came to agriculture, as it is surrounded by the wealth of farmland, Stanislaus County, which ranks 6th amongst Californian counties, grossing $3.1 billion in produce in 2011 alone. Chandra, as a child, was a fun-loving but had a playful streak of bossiness to her, especially with her younger brother. Susan Levy, her mother, had been quoted as saying, quote, "She didn't like being told what to do," end quote, and was very individualistic. Chandra played Little League and adored the baseball team San Francisco Giants. She volunteered for her local police department in a capacity that would inform them of establishments that sold alcohol to the underage, this not being indicative of her later choices to study in college. Chandra did in fact want to work in police and even had dreams of going into the FBI. In her younger years, she attended Grace M. Davis High School and then went on to San Francisco State University and earned herself a degree in journalism. She briefly worked in the office of LA Mayor Richard Reardon before attending the University of South California, gaining her master's in public administration. As part of her final semester, Chandra took a big step and moved to Washington, D.C., where she became a paid intern in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, where she would be assigned to the Public Affairs Office. This is where Chandra truly shined and impressed her supervisor, Dan Dunn, particularly of her handling of media inquiries in the execution of Timothy McVeigh. Eventually, Levy's internship was terminated in April 2001, as it had found her academic eligibility ended in December 2000. This, however, worked out well, as she had already completed her master's requirements and was set to return to California for her graduation that May. This news proceeded to her cancelling her gym membership and emailing her landlord she would be leaving the apartment where she lived in DuPont Circle. Sadly, however, Chandra would not make her appearance for graduation. Chandra was last seen physically on April 30th, and the next day she apparently left her flat to go jogging. It would be after five long and worrisome days that the Levy parents decide to contact the Metropolitan Department of the District of Columbia. They had called all the way from Modesto, and the police went to Chandra's flat to assess the situation, finding no indication of foul play. After some back and forth from Robert Levy and the police, he would inform them that Chandra had been having an affair with a US congressman. Later, Chandra's aunt told police that Chandra confided in her that the US congressman was Gary Condit. This was certainly shocking to be exposed, and the media were upon the story faster than anyone could blink, and in a way, the fate of the rest of the case was to be awash with folly and tribulation. Chapter 2. An Investigation Lost in Media. On May 10th, police gained a search warrant, wherein they began a formal search of Chandra's flat. It was clear to investigators from the start that Chandra was packing to leave, as there was partially filled suitcases present at the scene filled with clothes. What was peculiar though was Chandra's credit cards, mobile phone, and identification were all left behind in her purse, save for her keys and a gold ring with CL inscribed on it, her initials, which were not found at the apartment. Chandra's answering machine was full of messages, evidence of her being missing for a significant amount of time. Her laptop was also present at the scene, but when a police sergeant made an attempt to examine it, he accidentally corrupted the internet search. He wasn't a trained technician. While the search of the flat was conducted, local areas were searched along with Rock Creek Park, and Susan Levy was doing her own investigating, going through her daughter's cell phone history. She uncovered a series of calls to a number which when called went straight to US Congressman Condit, who even answered. At this point, canvases and searches of areas concluded with no evidence or sign of Chandra. It took computer technicians a month to finally reconstruct the corrupted data. Searches on the laptop did show it had been used the morning of May 1st, with sites related to Southwest Airlines, Amtrak, Baskin-Robbins, Condit, and a weather report from Washington Post. And her final search was at 12:59 for a region in France, Alsace-Lorraine. Another search that stood out to investigators at 11:33 a.m. was for information on Rock Creek Park, and then at 11:34 a link was clicked to bring up a map of the area. This brought 31 police cadets and sergeants down to search Glover Road in the park, but found nothing, and later a second search which yielded the same result. There was heavy media scrutiny around Chandra's case, unfortunately for all the wrong reasons, as it tied into the larger frame of a US congressman who represented the district in which the Lee family resided. This congressman was married and had an alleged affair with Chandra, an affair which Gary Condit at first denied, but which unidentified police sources claimed Condit admitted to the affair during an interview with law enforcement on July 7, 2001. Condit had said he had thought she was returning to DC after graduation and was surprised that she had ended her lease in the apartment. On July 10th, police searched his apartment, questioning people, and the federal officials began investigating Condit for partially obstructing justice, as it had come out A flight attendant named Anne Marie Smith claimed Condit told her not to talk to the FBI about his personal life. Smith was found to have also had an affair with Condit, but had never met Chandra. Even the Levi family felt Condit was being, quote, evasive and possibly hiding information about the matter, end quote. All this attention and probing into Condit's life brought forth a lot of things surely Condit wanted to keep closed. So much so that he refused to polygraph, though his attorney claimed he had passed one held by a private polygrapher. Media and public opinion of the congressman was at rock bottom proportions, and it ruined Condit's career. All this media frenzy put aside, there was the matter of Condit's overwhelming alibi for any potential wrongdoing on his part. Condit was in meetings with the then vice president, and officially, by police, had never been named a suspect. The attacks on September 11th ended media attention on Condit and Chandra's case. Chapter 3. Found. On May 22nd, 2002, as the healing slowly took place after the tragedy that took place in the US, about 9 a.m, a man named Philip Palmer was out in the woods of Rock Creek, walking his dog and looking for turtles. Palmer saw something that stuck out in the usual dark green, maroons, and other shades of leaves on the forest floor. Something bleach white, nearly indiscernible among the otherwise serene scenery. This prompted Palmer to investigate further, figuring it to be a turtle shell, but as he closed the distance to the peculiar object, interrupting the peaceful forest view, the grim and terrifying reality hit him. Amongst the ground lay a human skull. Palmer would frantically leave the area, but not before leaving some markers behind him, like a sweatshirt tied to a tree closer to the scene, so it could be found later. He made his way to a construction worker who was fixing up a house nearby to borrow his cell, and immediately called 911. Detectives arrived on the scene, and in confirmation of what Palmer had feared, they indeed found bones, along with personal effects, scattered in amongst the brush. The remains were not buried. The items that were found included a sports bra, sweatshirt, leggings, and tennis shoes, which would be bagged for evidence. The police had amazingly searched this area, over 1,700 acres of the park, but the slope that the remains had been found on was somehow overlooked. This was large in part due to a miscommunication from police commanders who ordered search perimeters to be within 100 yards of each road and trail, but officers only searched 100 yards of every road. The remains were identified as being Chandra Levy, true dental record match, and the scene where her remains were found was a mere 4 miles or 6 kilometers from where she had lived. With evidence gathered and an autopsy performed on the skeletal remains, DC police announced the status of investigation would be changed to a homicide, and a few days later, May 28, a medical examiner named Jonathan Arden confirmed it to be a homicide. He said, quote, "It's possible we may never know specifically how she died," end quote. He had found damage to her hyoid bone, which suggested the possibility of strangulation as means of death. Whether this could be conclusively confirmed as death, he couldn't say for sure. The Levy family hired their own private investigators, and as a side note, due to the number of errors the police have performed in this case up to now, who could really blame them for doing so? The PIs had found some twisted wire on her shin bone, about 23 meters from the other remains. This was a week from the initial discovery of her remains, and it was again somehow missed in the evidence collecting. A memorial service was held on May 28, 2002, at Modesto Center Plaza. A eulogy was delivered in both Hebrew and English, and was given to a massive crowd who came from far and wide, all in tribute and mourning of a, quote, "good person taken from us much too soon," end quote. Chapter 4. Park Attacks. The DC police had focused a lot of investigative resources in the pursuit of Gary Condit. It was no secret at this stage that the US congressman was neck high in controversy and very guarded about his supposed extramarital affairs. But unbeknownst to investigators, the day after Chandra Levy's disappearance, a 19-year-old, undocumented El Salvador immigrant did not show up for his construction job. His landlady noticed this young man looked physically bad, like he had been in a fight, with bruising on his face, a fat lip, and scratches around his throat. This same man would eventually be linked to two attacks in the Rock Creek area. One attack happened in mid-May. 30-year-old aspiring writer Haley Schilling was out on a run, something she did on the regular. It was evening, and she was going past an old mill, lost in the music playing on her Walkman. It was as she was continuing down the trail, she noticed a young Hispanic man near a parking lot. She passed it out of her mind and continued running. But not to her knowledge, the Hispanic man had begun pursuing her. He stalked her for a while, before at the top of a hill, the man initiated his attack. He jumped on her back and grabbed around Schilling's throat. They then both fell to the ground, where there was a struggle, and Schilling noticed the knife the man had. It was then instinct from self-defense classes Schilling had kicked in, and Schilling bravely stuck her fingers into the man's mouth, using her nails to scrape his tongue. The man had bit her fingers, but did eventually give up his grasp and fled the scene. Schilling, shocked and dazed, made her way to the park police station and reported the crime. Her Walkman nor her diamond engagement ring were taken, making robbery less of a motive, and more likely this was an attempted sexual assault. In the space of just 7 weeks, July 1st, 2001, once again in the evening time, 25-year-old lawyer Christy Wygand was out jogging with her fiancé in Rock Creek Park. The two would become separated as her fiancé ran ahead of her. It was so suddenly that her fiancé disappeared that a man grabbed her tightly and forced her off the trail. The assailant held a knife to Wygand, and though she initially struggled, the man ordered her to be quiet. Wygand submitted and stopped struggling, and the attacker slackened his hold a bit, just enough that Wygand once more began fighting back and screamed. The attacker fled and disappeared into the forest. Soon, Christy Wygand, shaking and cut but still alive, made her way hastily to a motorway. She flagged down a car, and a person gave her a lift to the US Park Police, and she gave her report, describing her attacker as a young Hispanic male wearing knee-length, black baggy shorts, a white tank top, and runners. Police did a wide search of the area and sent out a helicopter for aerial surveillance. Within 45 minutes of the attack, two police officers found a man on a golf course in Rock Park area, wearing wet clothes covered in dirt and leaves. Wygand was then brought to the scene, where she identified him as the man who attacked her. Park police processed the man, now identified as 19-year-old Ingmar Guandique, a Salvadorian who came to the US to work and send back money to his family, and an ex-girlfriend who eventually gave birth to their son. Guandique had been working construction and had developed a relationship with Iris Portillo, whom Guandique always tried to shower with exquisite gifts like jewelry. But as his job did not pay well and he wanted to give Portillo nice things, he began stealing. He'd be eventually arrested for burglaries. During this time, Guandique turned to drinking and began spending more time around the Rock Creek Park area, where he had brought Portillo on picnics to before. It was here as well, apparently, he began carrying a knife with him. After discovering old letters from ex-boyfriends of Portillo, Guandique flew into a rage and struck her. He then placed his hands around her throat. It was at this time her mother intervened, and Guandique was told to leave her daughter alone and never to return to the apartment. These patterns of violence and previous crime convictions, and the fact Wygand was able to identify him as the attacker, the park police were able to bring charges against Guandique. During questioning, a picture was shown to Guandique of Chandra Levy, and when asked did he recognize her, he replied yes, he had seen her at the old mill. When asked did he think she was attractive, he answered yes, but claimed he had never seen her again. As the Chandra Levy case was not Park Police case, connections were not made between the string of attacks and Chandra's disappearance, though it would not be too long until a jailhouse informant came out of the woodwork and made a claim that Gondike admitted to killing Chandra. This informant claimed this happened while the two were being held in jail, September 2001. Once more, a massive potential lead missed. It was only in 2006, after new investigators took over Chandra's now cold case, and when the Washington Post began doing their own investigation, that Gondike came back into the spotlight. In 2008, while Gondike's cell was searched, a picture of Chandra Levy was found that he had saved from a magazine. A year later, the Superior Court of DC issued an arrest warrant for his arrest, and 2 days later, he was charged with Levy's murder by indictment of grand jury. The 6 counts of indictment were as follows: first-degree murder committed during a kidnapping, attempted first-degree sexual abuse, first-degree murder committed during a sexual offence, attempted robbery, and first-degree murder committed during a robbery. Chapter 5. Trial of Gondike. The case that was built by the prosecutors on Ingmar Gondike was built on circumstantial evidence and predominantly on the testimony of a jail informant, Armando Morales. Morales had had his lawyer contact investigators as far back as September 2001, claiming he had knowledge of who killed Chandra. Morales had said Gondike had admitted to killing her after being offered $25,000 to carry out the hit by Condit. But investigators cleared his murder for hire allegations, as Gondike had already admitted to the other two assaults in the same park where Chandra's remains were found. Despite the integrity of their star witness already shaky, by October 18, 2010, jury selection had already begun, with an assortment of potential witnesses primed for the trial, including the two women Gondike had assaulted. Between October 25th and 26th, Schilling and Wygant recounted their experiences with Gondike, painting a picture to the jury of a habitual predator who stalked his victims alone or in vulnerable positions before making his move. Also on the 26th, Robert Levy, Chandra's father, took the stand. During his testimony, Robert did admit he had made claims in the past about believing Condit was responsible for his daughter's disappearance, whether it was in saying to the police that his daughter had told him that she and Gary Condit had a 5-year plan to get married. He said, quote, "I just said whatever came to my mind, to point to him as the villain," end quote. It was also Robert Levy's opinion early in the investigation that Chandra would be too cautious to jug alone, but later began to believe differently. All doubt in Condit being the culprit had melted in Robert's mind when he quotes, "until we learnt about this character here," end quote, in reference to Ingmar Gondike. Condit himself did take the stand on November 1st and was asked at least 3 times was he and Chandra having a sexual relationship. His response was that he did not want to, quote, "respond to that question out of privacy for myself and Chandra," end quote. Though underwear collected from Chandra's apartment did have semen on it that matched to Condit's DNA profile. However, a lot of the case against Gondike was built on Armando Morales, who shared a cell with him at the US Penitentiary in Kentucky. Morales stated that Gondike, afraid of being switched to prisons, as inmate violence against suspected rapists in 2006 was high, admitted to killing Chandra during a botched robbery, but did not rape her. The defense called other witnesses who refuted Morales' testimony. One of them was Jose Manuel Alanis. Alanis had said he had heard no mention of rape or murder while sharing a cell with Gondike and Morales. Though, whilst under cross-examination by the prosecution, Alanis said he was suffering from a gunshot wound and was often asleep. As the state of Chandra's remains were so decomposed to the point of skeletonization, and there being a lack of evidence of Gondike being there, it was the defense's position that the prosecution's case was fiction. Whilst prosecutor Amanda Haynes believed Gondike gagged and bound Chandra, and after attacking her, left her to die of either starvation or dehydration. The jury deliberated for 4 days, and by November 22, 2010, Ingmar Gwandike was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder. At sentencing, Judge Gerald Fisher handed down Gwandike 6 years in prison, stating that he will, quote, be a danger for some time, end quote. Gwandike did say to the family during sentencing, quote, I'm sorry for what happened to your daughter, end quote, but claimed insistently on his innocence. For the Levy family, the long and arduous journey to justice was fraught with grief, but now there was finally some answers and even justice. Unfortunately, that would all change as new evidence came to light and Gwandike was granted a new trial in April 2013. Chapter 6, Untrusty Morals and a House of Cards Falls Down. As the defense of Ingmar Gwandike built a new case filled with some new evidence, such as a 114-page motion which stated the prosecution failed to show or knew that Armando Morales had been proved to be a police informant, and a 911 call from a neighbor of Chandra's reported hearing, quote, a blood-curdling scream, end quote, at 4:37 a.m. A new defense strategy was soon being developed, one which would once again shine the light back on Gary Condit, and with the aim to investigate previous sexual relationships to see if there was any history of rough sex. But the future of the case, a new trial, took a massive blow as it was learned the prosecution's star witness, Morales, whose testimony from the first trial laid heavily on, had proven to have perjured himself. Not only did Morales fail to disclose that he had been a jailhouse informant with an untrusty reputation, which he denied, it would soon come to light of a secret recording existing which proved just how much Morales proved to be mistrustful. A part-time actress who had played an extra in the political show House of Cards would soon come into the case in quite a big way. Babs Prowler had been evicted from her house in July when she ended up staying at a hotel, the same hotel that Armando Morales had been staying. Morales befriended Prowler under the alias Phoenix. The two became friends, and Morales even watched Prowler's dog if she had to go out of town. But over time, the guise of Phoenix, this sweet gentleman Babs had come to know, started to slip, and she learned more about the man's past. A past that included him just having served a 20-year sentence. Also with this revelation, Morales told Babs that he was being put up in the hotel by the courts, as he was a star witness in the Gwandike trial and an omission on its own, which could jeopardize his credibility as a trustworthy witness. Bizarrely, and for whatever her motives, Prowler continued her odd friendship with Phoenix, but at some point decided she should start recording their conversations for her own safety. The recordings were made in Prowler's car, hotel room, but the majority of them in a storage locker where she held her stuff, and where ultimately Morales began making bold claims like he was in jail for gang racketeering and bragging how he is going to mess somebody up, and even had dark clothes and a hoodie ready so no one could know who he was. But when conversations came to his role in the court, he insisted Gwandike admitted to him he murdered her. Even when pressed by Prowler for more details, he maintained to what he said in court. But was there motive for Morales to lie under question of his testimony? The motion to which the defense of Gwandike filed did state that Morales had, quote, had a powerful motive to fabricate testimony, a desire for safety from enemies who want him dead, end quote. Prowler continued to record, even claiming she recorded Morales eventually admitting to him making the whole testimony up. Prowler then reaches out to Susan Levy about the encounters she had with Morales, and a baffled Susan directs Prowler to send the recordings to both the prosecution and the defense. Prosecution, upon hearing the tapes, admittedly not the supposed recording of Morales confessing to making up the testimony, immediately dropped the charges on Gwandike, stating, quote, the office has concluded that I can no longer prove the murder case against Mr. Gwandike beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote. The prosecution would, however, see Gwandike deported. This was a devastating blow for the Levy family, as of course, they had believed the man responsible for ending their daughter's life had been put behind bars, but now completely out of left field, their daughter's case went from a done deal in court back to a whodunit in the blink of an eye. Theories and conclusions. If this case did not have so many missteps in execution of investigation, communication, and of course, the near unrelentless media bias and coverage that played into Chandra's case, there may have been 100 different ways this case could have gone and should have went. As an outsider looking in, and with only a modicum of information, which I can wean from internet sources mostly, I do not have any journalistic or investigative experience. That said, however, I can see when a friend's story has gone off the rails of the subject matter and has become enamoured with gossip, spinning rumours as fact, or overall focusing on the sort of sex scandals that may or may not have happened, to boil it down to one simple thing. Chandra Levy died. Chandra Levy died sometime between May the 1st and her body was not found until a year later, completely picked of any semblance of the once beautiful, brown-haired young woman she was. Her body could have been found earlier if not for the police miscommunication. Okay, one mistake, right? No, rewind back that to a year before, when the police were searching Chandra's apartment and that police officer corrupted data on her laptop. Data that took a month to recover. Investigative efforts are hard, which I can understand, but why, oh why, was a cop who was untrained as a computer technician accessing her laptop? Even if it were 2001, computers were more of a specialised area, not one where everybody could just handle it like some odd task. And then the focus and scrutiny on Congressman Gary Condit. I get it. The man was rather suspect, with an evasive manner in confirming if he even knew Chandra for a start, and then to how many times he had seen her, to even if they had at all a sexual affair. But the media kept on him, trying him by essence in court of public opinion. He's guilty of adultery, so why not murder? This, at least in my opinion, hampered the investigation. To that end, even if Condit was guilty or had anything to do with Chandra's murder, there was already so much coverage of him, not just statewide, but nationwide, there couldn't be a court in America that could give him a fair trial, because he had already received one, a trial by media, and one of fire by that. I would just like to add, I am not defending Gary Condit. I think he's sleazy, slimy for what he did, how he just dodged questions, how he did not engage with the Levy family at all. All these things make him, in my opinion, a bad man. Yes, he committed adultery, it's obvious. But at the end of the day, that does not prove he's a murderer. The biggest frustration, at least in my opinion, was the missing of Gwandike. It's just another blunder that could have been chalked up to herd focus. But a good suspect he did look to be, at least from a circumstantial standpoint. History of crime, potential domestic abuse, and at least two attacks on women, one happening the week Chandra went missing. It was almost too perfect that it could be wrapped up so quickly. The attacks on the two women does show a habitual lenience to predatory actions, but there was no physical evidence of Ingmar Gwandike at the scene. And with all the pitfalls this case had already had, even with a suspect now firmly in place, the one smoking gun the prosecution had was Morales, a man responsible for perjuring himself, to the point that even if he or what he was saying was true, and that Gwandike did murder Chandra, his boasts and brags on the tapes that Prowler made did something. It completely collapsed a family's heart. It collapsed a case that was so unsteadily built to begin with, and most of all, it drowned out the true victim in all this, Chandra Levy. But that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is just what I think. What do you think? You can hit me up on all social media links by typing in Crime Obscene Pod. And until next time, stay safe.
What do you want people to know about your daughter, to remember about your daughter?
She was ambitious. She wanted to make a difference in this world. She was bright. She wanted to help and make a difference for our society. Unfortunately, maybe she's made a difference in a horrible way and raised consciousness in a terrible fashion.
Well, thank you for your strength, and thank you for being here today and keeping her story alive and campaigning for others. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.